Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Good afternoon. No. Okay, we have been studying we started the study last week, the Mahahatipadopama Sutta, the greater discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. This is Sutta number 28. In the Majjhima Nikaya. And I prepared a handout. Everybody have a copy of it. This shows on one page the structure of the sutta, which you can also see on the blackboard here, at least the first part. And so first, Venerable Sariputta, just to recapitulate what I covered last week, Venerable Sariputta begins with the statement that using the simile of the elephant's footprint, just as the footprint of all living beings that walk can fit within the footprint of the elephant. And so the elephant's footprint is declared the chief of them because of its great size. So too all wholesome states, or maybe all good teachings, can be included in the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so then we have the enumeration of the Four Noble Truths. The Noble Truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Then Sariputta takes the Noble Truth of suffering and divides it into different categories: birth, aging, and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, not to get what one wants as suffering. Then, in short and brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging or suffering. Okay, so then he takes out of these different types of suffering, he takes the five aggregates subject to clinging. We have the material form aggregate, the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the mental formations or volitional formations aggregate, and the consciousness aggregate. Then from these five aggregates, he takes just the material form aggregate, and he divides it first into the two basic types, the four great elements, and then the material form derived from the four great elements. Then he takes the four great elements. What are they? The earth element, water element, fire element, and the air element. And as I explained last week, according to the Buddhist philosophical analysis, these four elements are in a way symbolic representations of the four primary properties of matter. We could say solidity or resistance, that's the earth element. The water element is the property of liquidity, or we could say the cohesive factor, the factor that binds material particles together. The fire element is the factor of energy or heat. And the air element is the factor of pressure or expansion, or expansion and contraction. Then Sariputta takes the earth element out of the four elements, he takes the earth element, and he says the earth element may be either internal or external. Then taking the internal earth element, he enumerates 20 parts of the body that are examples of the earth element. And as I mentioned last week, according to the Buddhist analysis, any material entity actually consists of the four elements together. The four elements are always anyamanya pachaya, which means that they're indissolubly bound together. They're conditions for one another. They always exist depending upon one another. So you can never have any material substance without all four elements being present. But in one particular material entity or another, one of these four elements will be predominant. So in things that are solid, the earth element will be prominent. In things that are liquid, the water element or the liquid element will be prominent. In fire, the heat element will be prominent. In the air element will be prominent. Okay, so we have these 20 parts of the body in which the earth element is prominent. And we see the earth element defined in these 20 parts of the body as that which is solid, solidified, and the expression used here, clung to, has a sense of organic. So head hairs, body hairs, nail, teeth, skin, and so on. And those of you who are familiar with the meditation on the 32 parts of the body will recognize these 20 parts as also included in these 32 parts that are supposed to illustrate the unattractive or foul nature of the body. But there's a difference. When one is doing the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body, and one takes these parts of the body, then one is trying to focus on these parts in order to see how they're unattractive or repulsive. When one is doing the meditation on the elements, then one is taking these parts of the body in order to see them simply as examples or manifestations of the earth element, to see them simply as things that are solid, substantial, hard, resistant. And so one is not focusing upon the unattractive nature, the asubha, the foul nature, but rather on the solid, substantial, hard nature of these things. Okay, and so this is the internal earth element. And now we come to this important sentence. Now both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply the earth element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom, with correct wisdom, thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. This is the way that one breaks down the identification with the body through seeing the continuity between the earth element of the body and the external earth element. Seeing even more than the continuity, seeing that the earth element of the body, this solid, hard, substantial nature of the body and this hard, solid, substantial nature of external material objects are identical with respect to their hardness or solidity. And when one sees it thus, then one loses this identification with the body. One sees that this earth element of the body is not mine, not I, not myself. And then when one sees it in this way, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element. One loses one's illusions about it. One doesn't imagine that this earth element that makes up the body has anything essential about it that merits identifying it as being I or mine, a truly existing self. And then the mind becomes dispassionate towards the earth element. It loses its attachment to the earth element. Okay, in the outline that I prepared, this section that I just explained comes under what I call the elaboration. This is part B1, where one is coming to an understanding of non-self, the selfless nature of the body, through seeing the similarity of the internal and external manifestations of each of the four great elements. And now with paragraph 7, we're going to approach the understanding of non-self from a different angle. This will come about through understanding the impermanence of the elements. And here, Venerable Sariputta appeals to, this is a kind of Buddhist conception of, call this the last days or the eventual destruction of the world, one of the ways in which the world is destroyed. There comes a time when the water element is disturbed. This is supposed to be some time far in the future when maybe it's coming closer with rising sea levels, global warmings, rising sea levels, the oceans start to extend and to swallow up the earth, and then eventually the earth element vanishes. And so when even this external earth element, in the Buddhist conception, this is sometime in the distant future when there's supposed to be like great upheavals on the earth, and this is like tsunamis taking place all over, great earthquakes, and then the oceans inundate all of the continents and just swallow up all of the solid land, which just gets swept away under and pulled down under the ocean. And so when even this external earth element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what can be said of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering this as I, or mine, or I am. One might even, instead of using this example of the eventual destruction of the earth element in the future, one might use instead the contemplation of what happens at death. What takes place at death is that, okay, the body, the life force in the body is dissolved, then this body remains, and if it's buried, eventually the earth element of the body disintegrates, and the earth of the body will just become part of the general earth element of the world. If the body is cremated, then the liquid will go out, will evaporate, and what will remain are just ashes and bones, which is just earth element. And then that will be buried someplace, or just discarded someplace, and it just blends in with the rest of the earth element of the world. And so what is this body that we take now, the solid body, to be I and mine? When it disintegrates, it turns into just earth element and becomes part of the greater earth element of the world. And who can say that the earth that we walk on every day, the soil, that could be the dissolved bodies of so many millions of living creatures who have previously walked on this earth and considered themselves I, me, and mine, but now they're no more, and so their bodies become part of the earth, part of the soil. Okay, so now Venerable Sariputta is going to show how this reflection on the elements, this meditation on the elements, can be used as a means for developing patience under very difficult conditions, under conditions when one is subject to abuse, to harassment, to persecution. Okay, so he takes the example of a case when others might abuse, revile, scold, and harass a monk, such a monk, that is one who has done this meditation on the elements. Okay, normally a person, when he's subject to abuse, what do? But abuse in return. If they're reviled, they revile in return. If they're scolded, they argue back and scold in return. If somebody harasses, then they retaliate. But that is not the way of practice of a samana, of a renunciant or an ascetic. Instead, an ascetic has to develop patience. And so one way to develop this patience is by learning to contemplate this difficult, trying situation. Contemplate this situation in terms of bare, conditioned, and conditioning factors of experience. And so when one is subject to this abuse and scolding and harassment from others, then one contemplates, okay, there has arisen a painful feeling. And one considers, this painful feeling has arisen in me. How has that arisen? It has arisen on account of ear contact. There has arisen in me a painful feeling born of ear contact. Okay, that feeling is dependent. It's something conditioned. It's not independent. What is it conditioned by? What does it depend on? It depends on contact. Okay, and so now he's going to turn the situation not only into a way to develop patience, but even into a way to develop insight. So he sees that contact is impermanent. He sees that feeling is impermanent. That perception is impermanent. Those formations, those volitional formations, are impermanent. And he sees that this consciousness is impermanent. And so he's turning this, taking this situation, this afflictive situation, and dissolving it into an experience that's conditionally arisen, and then dissecting the experience into components which are assigned to their places within the five aggregates. Here we have the four aggregates: feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. And then the ear and sounds would be included within the form, the material form aggregate. And then we have a sentence which is rather difficult, even in the Pali. Tassa dhatu aramanam eva chitang pakandati pasidati santitati adimuchati. Which can be, the sentence can be understood in two different ways. Could be understood one way, his mind takes the elements as its object and enters into them and thereby acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution. On that interpretation, the mind is taking the ear element and the taking the ear and the sound as elements, because the ear and the sound are also dhatus. They are part of the 18 dhatus: ear element, sota dhatu, and sound element, saddha dhatu. And so now, on that interpretation, he's turning away from the earth element and taking sound element, ear element, as the object of support, and then building his meditation on that basis. On the other interpretation, which is the one on which this translation is based, and his mind, having made an element its object support, that is, the mind which has made the earth element his object support, that is, the mind which has been trained using the earth element as its primary meditation object, now enters into this new field of contemplation, that is, observing the contact, feeling, perception, the formations, and consciousness, and thereby acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution. Either way, there's not much difference. It's just really the way the sentence is interpreted. But in actual practical terms, what it boils down to is pretty much the same thing. What it means is that, as I explained, is that the monk is now contemplating or observing this living situation, which is a very difficult and trying situation, a time of tribulation, and instead of falling into either anger, self-pity, misery. He's using it as a field of meditation in order to understand first the conditionality, the conditioned arising of experience, seeing how this unpleasant experience is something that arises through conditions, through sense objects impinging on sense faculties, and then seeing the impermanent nature of each factor of this experience. And then from impermanence, one can go into the unsatisfactory nature and then into the selfless nature of these factors. And then this will fortify the mind and lead to the establishing of patience. Okay, paragraph 9 gives another method for developing this patience and equanimity. And I asked myself, why are two different methods given here? And a hypothesis that I would come up with, I'm not sure that this is correct, but this is just an explanatory hypothesis, is that paragraph 8, that method, is intended for those practitioners who are predominantly of a wisdom temperament, who like to use wisdom to dissect, analyze, and investigate experience. Whereas the method explained in paragraph 9 is more for those who are of a faith or devotional temperament, because it appeals to a saying of the Buddha. And so one recollects the Buddha and the example held up by the Buddha and tries to follow that example. Also, the ways given here in paragraph 9, these are more severe types of attacks. So maybe one has to use the example that the Buddha gives in another sutta in order to fortify the mind even more strongly than the method in paragraph 8 makes possible. Now, Sariputta says, if others attack that monk in disagreeable ways, now it's not just verbally, by reviling him and abusing him, but they attack him with their fists, with clods of earth, with sticks, even with knives. Then he reflects and understands thus, this body is of such a nature that contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail it. It's not that one goes about looking to be attacked, but if one can't avoid being attacked, then in order to prevent anger from arising, fear from arising, to remain patient, to maintain equanimity, one reflects that this is the nature of bodily existence. And then to keep the mind under control, to prevent anger from arising, one appeals to this famous simile of the saw. We already came across this, maybe it's a couple of years ago, in Sutta number 21 of the Middle Length Discourses. The Buddha says, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, one who gave rise to a mind of hatred towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. And that sutta, the Buddha then goes on to explain how in such a situation one should develop metta or loving kindness even towards those bandits who are cutting you apart limb by limb. And so here Venerable Sariputta says, in this way, reflecting in this way, then one thinks that tireless energy should be aroused in me. Unremitting mindfulness should be established. My body shall be tranquil and untroubled. My mind concentrated and unified. So here we have three spiritual faculties: energy, mindfulness, concentration. Okay, and then one makes this determination, let contact with fists, claws, sticks, and knives assail this body, because one knows this body is not myself, and that is just how the Buddha's teaching is practiced. Okay, then paragraph 10, Venerable Sariputta says, when this monk thus recollects the Buddha, he recollects the Buddha because he's recollecting this saying of the Buddha, he's recollecting the Dhamma because this is the teaching, and he's recollecting the Sangha. I guess because this is the ideal practitioner, the way an ideal practitioner should practice. Then, if equanimity supported by the wholesome, this is an important expression, upeka kusala nisita. This means a wholesome type of equanimity. If this type of equanimity doesn't become established in him, then he should arouse a sense of urgency. Here we have two important expressions which are sort of played off against one another. One is this expression, equanimity supported by the wholesome, and the other is a sense of urgency, sangvega. Okay, the ideal here is to establish this wholesome equanimity. This is the balance of mind which cannot be disturbed even under these most difficult conditions when subject to abuse, to scolding, to harassment, to attack by others, when subject to physical attack, even to beatings by clubs, by knives. I mean, it's a very difficult ideal, but that is the ideal towards which one should strive. And now, when one cannot establish that equanimity, then one has to arouse this quality called sangvega. Sangvega is what we translate here as a sense of urgency. And it's one of the key terms in Buddhism. It's a sense of inner commotion, inner disturbance, which drives one to the fulfillment of higher ideals. People sometimes think that the goal for Buddhism is just to be able to live placidly and contentedly. That's not the case. But sangvega is a quality of a kind of disturbance that doesn't allow one to remain content with any lower level of achievement, but continually impels one to strive for higher levels of achievement when one sees the flaws, the defects in lower levels of achievement. The earliest sense of Sangvega is what, for example, what the Bodhisattva felt when he was living in the palace, when he first reflected on old age, sickness, and death. Or in the legend of the Buddha, when he first saw the old man, the sick man, and the dead man. It's that kind of disturbance, that agitation that breaks one's complacent adjustment to the comfortable routines of everyday life. And that gives one this inner drive, the sense that there is some deep problem, this inherent contradiction or unsatisfactoriness at the base of human life that one has to resolve, that one has to disentangle. And that again, it is the Sangvega which does not allow one to remain content with any lower level of achievement, but continually pushes one on until one can finally say, done is that which had to be done. Okay, and so when this monk is not able to establish his wholesome equanimity, he arouses the sense of urgency by reflecting that it is a loss for him that when he recollects the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, he is not able to establish this wholesome equanimity. But if he's able to establish that wholesome equanimity, Sariputta says, then he can be satisfied with it. And at that point, much has been done by him. Okay, at this point I'll ask if there's any questions. Yes, Jim?
That word Sangvega, if you were to break it down, what you do?
What is the root of Sangvega? Yeah. Yeah, one part of the verbal root is vega. Vega has the sense of movement, suggests wave-like movement, and sang is intensification. So it's like an intensified wave-like movement. Sangvega, uvega. But one can't get the real meaning through verbal analysis. One has to get to know the meaning of a word through seeing how it's used. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Any questions? Yeah.
So going to the end of paragraph 6, sure. I guess from last week, it says, when one sees it thus as it actually is a proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element. It makes the mind as passionate towards the earth element. So there seems to be like a passive part to that and an active part to that. Is that accurate? He becomes disenchanted and then makes the mind as passionate.
Yeah, this is unusual because usually, in the Pali, we have, okay, nibindati, nibindang, virajati. One becomes disen, chanted, having become disenchanted or becoming disenchanted, one becomes dispassionate. So that is a passive verb form, virajati. One becomes dispassionate or one becomes detached. But this uses a causative form, chitang virajeti, which means one makes the mind dispassionate or one makes the mind detached. It seems that even though the active form is used, I don't see that one really does anything special to make the mind detached apart from continuing to see the element as it really is with right wisdom. Yeah, I would say that it is the seeing with right wisdom that naturally leads to disenchantment and that leads to dispassion. And one could just phrase the same idea alternately as one becomes dispassionate or detached, or one makes the mind dispassionate, one makes the mind detached. It's just a matter of which expression one wants to use. I can't see any particular reason why the causative form has been used here rather than just the normal passive form. Could it be because Venerable Sariputta is speaking, not the Buddha, and so he's has his own way of speaking, maybe, not just repeating exactly the words that the Buddha uses. Though, I'm just wondering if the same passage occurs in another sutta where it's spoken by the Buddha. That's possible too. Okay, if there's no more question, yeah.
I'm not sure I understand how the studying of the elements, or the maybe studying is the wrong word, but the focus of the elements is used in the discussion in paragraph 8. I agree. It is difficult in English, however, whichever translation you gave. I'm just trying to understand it. Is it that you're using your understanding? Your insight into the nature of the elements as a basis for being able to observe properly, or is there something about the elements that you're observing in a difficult situation that's going wrong?
Say again, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure how the elements
are
used in that last sentence of paragraph 8.
Mm-hmm. I mean the two alternatives that I...
Well, either one.
Okay.
I mean, I followed when you said it pretty much boiled down to the same thing, and I understood that, but what I don't understand in your description is where do the elements fit in there?
Okay. There are two, first, maybe I should clarify, two different ways of analyzing or explaining this idea of elements. The word dhatu is used, meaning elements, is used for different categories of things in Buddhism. One is the four, sometimes six elements. These are the four material elements, earth, water, fire, and air, and sometimes added the space element and the consciousness element. So we have these six elements. And another scheme is called the 18 elements. Those are six sense faculties, six sense objects, the corresponding objects, and six classes of consciousness, the six corresponding types of consciousness. Okay, now two ways of interpreting the sentence. One is, having made the elements its objective support. That means having made some elements among the 18 elements, having taken sound and the ear as the objective support. His mind enters into this situation and then is now examining the situation from the standpoint of ear contact, the feeling, painful feeling born of ear contact. And then in terms of the aggregates, feeling, perception, the volitional formations, the consciousness, all of them based upon hearing sounds with the ear. The other way is based upon still the idea of the material elements, using the earth, the mind which has been developing the meditation using the material elements as its objective support, the earth element. So now because the mind has been trained based on the earth element, so now when this harassment and reviling and abuse occurs, now one enters into this, I could just see it now from a different point of view, still another point of view. I just saw a different way to understand it. Okay, let me just continue along that way. Okay, so the mind which has been trained using the earth element as its support now enters into this new situation and investigates the situation from the standpoint of the events that are taking place there. But it's still the mind that has been based upon the training with the earth element. But it's now turning away from the earth element and it's entering into the new situation.
So it's not observing the earth element aspects of the situation.
No, no.
You've got your training in the earth element.
Yeah.
And now you're focused.
Yeah. Right, yeah. In fact, the second way of explanation seems more reasonable to me because the sutta has been speaking about these four primary elements. It's not been speaking about the 18 elements. Yeah, George.
This sutta seems to be one that was created much later than other sutras. I say that because whether it refers to the simile of the two-handed saw, and it seems to have referred to summaries of the teachings.
It doesn't mean that it was much later.
I didn't mean to say much later so much as not one of the originals.
What do you mean by the originals?
Well, the very first. But by that I mean not compiled 200-300 years later by the Sangha.
If this was compiled 200 or 300 years later. I'm not so sure. I have to check. I didn't look before the class. I didn't look to compare it with the Agama counterpart, which doesn't really give much help for determining in terms of 200 or 300 years. It has some features which indicate some stages of development of the thought. It certainly belongs to the early period. But it shows some elaboration, intellectual elaboration, which though that seems to be characteristic of the thought of Sariputta, his style of thinking. This, which we find especially towards the end of the sutta, his mode of thinking, this analytical way of thinking, kind of dissecting experience into its components. So I don't think that that necessarily makes it late in the sense of coming after the time of the Buddha himself. Of course, all of the suttas that we have develop out of Nukleya Suttas, and they were elaborated over time. None of them are completely archaic in that sense, without any elaboration or editing or revisions by the Sangha. Yeah.
May I ask you, are you saying that paragraph 8 is moving away from the contemplation of the four great elements?
No, I said that one way of interpreting the last sentence in paragraph 8, that phrase, having made an element its objective support, this is the commentary, offers one way of interpreting this in terms of taking the ear and sounds as its object, because those are also elements among the 18 elements. And I said that would be moving away from the use of the four great elements and taking a different classification of elements. And that seems to me less convincing than a way of explanation which understands the element here to be the earth element. Because the sutta has been speaking about the four great elements. It hasn't been speaking about the sense objects and sense faculties as elements. So I don't think the text would use the word element here in the sense of the sense objects and sense faculties.
But it seems to me, even though sense object, sense faculties, these elements are also made of the four great elements, so there is connection. And Sariputta is, I think, is using this way to understand.
But still, it would be a little bit. The idea would not be so immediately clear to be using the word element. This is just my opinion, in the sense of sense organ and sense object. When the sutta begins speaking about the primary elements, I would just think that it would make more sense to keep the word element in the sense of the four primary elements. It would be more consistent with the way the sutta is developing. But they can't, I mean, there can be different ways of looking at it. I don't. Yeah, though the scheme of the 18 elements, it doesn't come so often in the suttas. I mean, it's possible. One could see it in different ways. Yeah, though things like contact, feeling, perception, the mental formations, consciousness, those wouldn't be made out of the four great elements. Though one can classify those in terms of the 18 elements, though that gets a rather that becomes a rather complicated procedure. Anyway, there are just different ways of interpreting, and so one could choose whichever interpretation seems more meaningful, more appealing to oneself. Okay, any further questions? Okay, then we will end for the evening with the sharing of the merits. And continue next week. I'll try to finish the sutta. I'll just go quickly through the other material elements next week because they're very similar to the earth element. And I want to focus more next week on the closing paragraphs on the way the five aggregates come into being. That is from paragraph 27 to the end. Those are the more interesting paragraphs. Akasata chabhumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta